I want to just draw your attention first to the end of the discussion, because I think what we want to do is to try to see how it arrives at this denouement, where we push off into a new shape of consciousness that really is going to be engaged in a kind of modality different from anything that's occurred so far. And if you look on page 201, the very last lines, actually, to take the last part of the paragraph, Hegel begins by saying how actually, maybe we should begin farther up. So it says, likewise, only in itself is its impoverished activity the inverse, namely absolute activity, or to put it in terms of the concept, an activity is only an activity at all, as the activity of an individual. Just as you know, you have here a kind of inversion of sorts.
What paragraph are you?
This is on page 201. And sort of the last part of that final paragraph.
What section? What's that?
230. Paragraph 230?
Page 201.
The last paragraph.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I should have said that. 230. Paragraph 230. Says, within this object, its being and its doing and its being as this individual consciousness, is in its eyes being and doing in itself, as being and doing in an absolute sense, in truth. Thus, within this object, the representational thought of reason has in its eyes come to be. This is the representational thought. When he says representational thought, by the way, the translation is just a Vorstellung. He could have just said representation, perhaps. This is the representation of the certainty for this consciousness, that it exists absolutely in itself, within its individuality, that it is its certainty of being all reality. Okay. So, something is happening here through these kind of final sacrifices that occur, that are actually going to, in a certain respect, achieve the kind of reconciliation that has been sought after, although by transforming things. That is, you can speak of it as reconciliation to the extent that the two sides now, in a way, are merged, in that consciousness recognizes that in its individuality it is at one with the truth of all objectivity, that there isn't this divide that had been the basis for all of the operations of the unhappy consciousness. And this is going to have some connection with reason, or you might even say with rationality, or with the consciousness that's aware of itself as being fully rational. To the extent that it recognizes this kind of intrinsic identity between the contents of its own awareness and what is objective. You might ask yourself, by the way, what does that have to do with rationality or reason? Well, to some degree, what does reason presume if we regard ourselves in the shape of consciousness as having a consciousness that is a form of reason or is rational? That is, in its confrontation with the given, what if it takes itself to be, in effect, reason or fully rational? What is it going to be? How is it going to be regarding itself in its own individuality and all the content it has. Well, regard the content of its awareness as being determinative of what is up, what is objective, as being, you know, intrinsically at one with what's objective. And another way in which you're going to see this formulated to distinguish reason and the shapes of consciousness from those that preceded is that in reason you have a kind of unification of self-consciousness and consciousness, where consciousness as reason is going to be confronting an objectivity it distinguishes from itself, but at the same time it regards it as being in identity with consciousness's own determinations. So that consciousness's own determinations are going to truly lay hold of what confronts it as other. And that sort of being the presupposition, the operating presupposition of rationality, when rationality takes the form of a reason that confronts the given. And thinks or reads off the character of the given in its theorizing. Now, we ought to see how we get to this, because at times it might appear that in 229 and 230, the reconciliation being sought by unhappy consciousness is being looked upon as being something that hasn't succeeded. Or at least the terms on which it's been operating really have not managed to get anywhere. I mean, you know, we've reached this penultimate situation that's described in the beginning of 229, whereas Hegel writes, it's on page 199, by way of these moments of first surrendering its own decision. And where has it surrendered its own decision? Where does that occur? This would be specifically in reference to what relationship we were talking about recently. Yeah, with the mediator.
Turning over,
right? It's submitted to the mediator, you know, the clerical authority or the like, surrendered its own decision, then surrendering its property and consumption, and finally, by way of the positive moment of carrying out a task it does not understand. Because remember, it not only has surrendered its decision by bowing to the authority of the mediator, but it's done what the authority has told it to do. Not on the basis of having some understanding of it and recognizing it to be rational, but because it's been told by a transcendent, right, authority. Well, it deprives itself in truth and completely of the consciousness of inner and outer freedom, of actuality as its being for self. Right? I mean, in what sense is its actuality something that is in no respect being for self or something to which it's self-related? Well, it would seem that in a way it's transformed itself by, in a sense, undercutting its own individuality and estranged itself in all of these sacrifices. Right? It's allowed something external to itself or other than itself to be determinative. So, as Hegel goes on to say, it has a certainty of having in truth emptied itself of its I, and of having made its immediate self-consciousness into a thing, into an objective being. Right? It's become a thing, an objective being. It's determined by something else. It's alien to its I, right? It sacrifices, he said, everything regarding its inner and outer freedom. Well, you know, is this then a successful reconciliation? Well, he goes on to say, you know, it could prove the worth of its self-renunciation, solely by this actual sacrifice, for only in that sacrifice does the deception vanish, which lies in the inner recognition of giving thanks by way of the heart and by way of one's disposition and one's speech. In that self-renunciation, there is a bestowal of recognition that shifts all the power of being for itself away from itself and instead treats its power as a gift from above. Now, how does the sacrifice lead the deception to vanish? The deception that was there by regarding what is going on as one did by giving thanks. What is he getting at here? I mean, it's something that he then discusses more explicitly in what follows when he says, in this very act of shifting, a couple sentences later, it itself retains its external ownness in the possession which it does not give up, and it retains its inner ownness both in the consciousness of the decision that it itself has taken and in the consciousness of the content determined by way of itself. Moreover, it has not exchanged that content for an alien, meaninglessly specified content. What's he getting at here? Because he now seems to be contradicting what he just said about it before. Right. Because to begin with, he speaks as if the self has emptied itself of its I. Right. And yet, this actual sacrifice, nevertheless, has made the deception vanish. That deception involved in the giving of thanks, you know.
What's right. The deception? It's vanishing.
Yeah, what do you think it is? You're asking what it is?
Yeah, is it the deception that through my own individuality I can unite myself with the essential, that somehow I'm giving that up?
Well, he speaks of the deception in the following ways. He says the deception lies in the inner recognition of giving thanks by way of the heart and by way of one's disposition and one's speech. Giving thanks for what? I mean, what is the thanks? When did he bring up thanks before? I mean, it had to do with the second way of relating to the divine.
Insofar as our activity actually affected anything, it was... Yeah. Sort of a gift and giving thanks for that ability to change things.
You know, and if you ask yourself, well, in what respect is it a deception? Well, it's a deception to think that this was something that occurs completely independent of one's doing, right? So here he immediately speaks of how, in fact, right, here the sacrifice is something that one undertakes, or that one has undertaken, after all. You know, one has chosen to obey the authority. One has chosen, right, to live in impoverishment. One has chosen to... these are all activities one has undertaken, even though the whole point of it is to sort of remove one's active engagement as an independent individual. And yet that sort of, that negating of oneself, that submitting and so forth, is really something that... one has done oneself here. So in this respect, as he says, you know, it's not exchange that content for an alien meaninglessly specified content. One has chosen to do it. Now, nevertheless, he does go on to say that something, you know, it's not just that this hasn't operated as it was taken to be, right? It was presented as if the sacrifice was one in which one eliminates the enemy within, right? The enemy constituted by one's own individuality, which is distinct from what lies in the beyond. You know, one's final way of attempting that through sacrificing everything that seemed to involve our individuality as a sacrifice is something we undertake. So in some respect, there's no getting away from this individuality, since we're talking about engagements that itself has been doing. So in this respect, it hasn't achieved what it sought to do. It hasn't removed that individuality and thereby achieved reconciliation. But this whole thing has a different significance, a further significance, which he now outlines in paragraph 230, where precisely because one can understand what has been done as being one's own individual engagement. It's an individual engagement which at the very same time has been determined to be, in a sense, in unity with what is regarded to be true and fundamental and of universal significance. And I think that's what he wants to spell out here. So, I mean, you can actually look at the text itself. He writes on 230, paragraph 230, page 200, he says, however, in the actual completed sacrifice, its unhappiness has in itself been purged from it, just in the way that consciousness has sublated its activity as its own. Now, in what sense has its unhappiness in itself been purged from it? And when he says in itself, he's distinguishing that from for itself, right? It's not as if for consciousness it's been purged, but in itself, for in truth, it's been purged. In what sense has it been purged through the completed sacrifice? In the way that consciousness has related its activities and so on.
If it's really sacrificed its individuality, then it doesn't, there's not a discrepancy between that and the essential anymore.
Yeah, I mean, if it really has succeeded in thoroughgoingly eliminating its distinguished individuality, then the basis for the divide and the unhappiness and so forth is removed. But, he says, however, that this purging has taken place in itself, that has taken place in itself, is itself an activity that has been carried out by the other extreme term of the syllogism, which is the essence existing in itself. And when he says it's an activity carried out by the other extreme term of the syllogism, you know, the essence existing in itself, what is he referring to, of course?
The alien essence that we're trying to get access to.
Yeah, and why would one attribute it as being what has affected this purging, what the sacrifice has done?
Well, the other side.
Why would that be the import of what has happened?
The other side's been purged. It's gone.
And remember, the purging is to the effect of showing that the truth of the self is this other consciousness. I mean, really, the truth, for that truth to be realized, is equivalent to sacrificing itself as having any independent role to play. So what has occurred owing to that to which the self is seeking unification. Which we've already seen in a way at various junctures, right, in the second manner of attempting to reconcile with this essential consciousness, right? One acted on the world, but if anything was accomplished, it was thanks to what this true consciousness allowed to take place. Well, here that applies equally to the sacrifice oneself makes, right? It's not just that alterations to the world are really not one's own responsibility, but even the alterations of ourself are really affected by what we take to be true and fundamental. But, I mean, and that's the import of what's going on, right? I mean, if you take all of this seriously, put yourself within the unhappy consciousness, this is how it has to regard what's going on. Right, has to regard the very sacrifice it takes, whereby it's eliminating its own independence and opposition to what has truth for it, as being something that is in truth really affected by what it's seeking to unite to as its own truth. But, as Hegel once again points out, that sacrifice of the inessential extreme term was at the same time not a one-sided act. Instead, it contained the other's activity within itself. Thank you. might ask yourself, which other is he talking about here? In a way, it may not make any difference as long as both of them are involved. But for on the one hand, he says, surrendering one's own will is merely negative in terms of its concept, that is, in itself. But at the same time, it is positive. Specifically, it is a positive of the will as another. And especially, it is a positive of the will as universal, not as the will of an individual. Well, surrendering one's will is negative with respect to oneself, but it's positive with respect to what else? The essential consciousness that one is seeking to unite with, right? It is, in a sense, its will, and a will that is universal, not merely individual. For this consciousness, the positive significance of the negatively posited individual will is the will of the other extreme term. You know, for this consciousness, the unhappy consciousness, it regards the sacrifice of its own will as being, in a sense, the act of the will of what it's seeking to unite or what it regards as true. This consciousness, the positive significance of a negatively positive individual will, is the will of the other extreme term, which precisely because it is another for consciousness, becomes in its eyes the act of giving counsel. What is he getting at here? Why is he bringing now the act of giving counsel? How does the act of giving counsel, in a way, give expression of the fact that the willing that has been done, which is tantamount to forfeiting one's own freedom and submitting to counsel, is actually an expression of the will of the other extreme, or how the act of giving counsel is the expression of the other extreme? Of course, that's what it has to be taken as anyhow, right? I mean, that's what it's really regarded as by the consciousness that submits to the counsel, right? It takes that act of counsel not just as a mundane master, but as, in a sense, the will of the absolute consciousness, the unchanged consciousness. And it becomes this not by way of itself, but by way of the third term, the mediator. By way of the mediator, what it does is the expression of the will of, well, one could say, the transcendent consciousness, divine. And now here we have a kind of turning point. He says, hence, for consciousness, its will becomes universal will, a will existing in itself. Although in its own eyes, it itself is not this will in itself. What's he getting at here? Someone has explained this, I think. It's, you know, a sort of restatement of what. How does consciousness's will here become for itself a universal will, a will existing in itself in truth? Although in its own eyes, in consciousness's own eyes, it itself is not this will in itself. Because that, in a sense, is sort of the problem.
The individual sort of dissolves itself in the universal. So the universal becomes the will.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's part of the individual consciousness, I guess.
But there's also this other side to it. I mean, precisely because this has occurred through sacrifice, even though it now recognizes it in a sense, what was its will was actually the will of, you know, the transcendent consciousness, it still can't recognize that will to be its own. It still can't recognize its immediate identity with it. Because this did take the form of a sacrifice, after all. So even though its will was actually the will, what seemed to be its willing was actually the will of this other consciousness, it still is not identifiable with its willing. as he goes on to say, that it surrenders its own will as an individual will, is both in its own eyes and in terms of the concept, not what is positive about the universal will. What's it getting at here? It's not what's positive about the universal will, the fact that it surrenders its own will, both its own eyes and then kind of the concept of what's going on. Well, remember, the surrendering is something it does, right? But its surrendering is not part of what has taken place, supposedly truly, over it. That is just the exercise of the universal will. But surrendering is something distinct. And likewise, this applies to the rest of what's going on. Its surrender of possessions and its abandonment of consumption likewise merely have the same negative significance. And the universal which thereby comes to be for it is in its eyes not its own activity. Right, they have negative significance. It's a renunciation of the individuality of the individual. But this is supposed to be, in a sense, the doing of the universal will. But that's not its own activity. It's an activity different from itself. You know, its renunciation is just, or its surrender is just an appearance, in effect. So he goes on, with regard to this unity of objective being and being for itself, which lies in the concept of activity, and which for that reason in the eyes of consciousness comes about as the essence and object, just as this unity is in the eyes of consciousness, not the concept of its activity, it is also not the case that in the eyes of consciousness the unity comes to be immediately as an object for that consciousness and by way of itself. So what is he emphasizing here? What is this unity of objective being and being for itself? Remember, whenever you come across this term being for itself, you're talking about self-relation. So there's this objective being, and an objective being that comprises something in which something is related to itself. What is the objective being that's being referred to here? And you can speak of it as a whole, in its entirety, it's the whole domain of the sacrifice, all of those things that comprise the sacrifice, which are in truth, right, the workings of the transcendent divine, or transcendent consciousness. But that's not something in which the individual consciousness finds itself, right? This is occurring on the part of the divine here.
Like the sacrifice?
So as he says, you know, for that reason, the unity, you know, it doesn't come to be in the eyes of consciousness as an object for consciousness and by way of itself. Right? It does not see this unity. It doesn't see itself at one with what has occurred. And then he goes on to say, rather, consciousness, it lets the mediating servant articulate the still shattered certainty that articulation turns out to be that it is only in itself that its unhappiness is the universe, is the inverse. That is to say, only in itself is it a self-satisfying activity or a blessed enjoyment in consuming. Likewise, only in itself is its impoverished activity the inverse, namely absolute activity, the activity of the absolute consciousness. Or to put it in terms of the concept of activity, is only an activity at all as the activity of an individual. Well, all of this is only in itself the act of the essential consciousness. Because for consciousness, there's still this discrepancy. Because after all, when all of these moves are made, attributing what occurs to the other consciousness, precisely by doing that, consciousness is not in a position to recognize, at least the individual consciousness, not in a position to recognize what's happening as its own. So admittedly, it's attempting to sacrifice its own separation by removing its separateness. But there's something sort of one-sided by the solution. But there is this however then that's going to lead to the new development. And what I suggest we do, since we're now a little bit over, why don't we look at this last part of the paragraph, which so far seems to look at things as being rather unresolved, despite what has happened, and to look at how there's something new under the sun. Starting with however within this object, blah, blah. And let's look at that in terms of the opening of what happens next time with reason and see what new terrain we've entered and how it sheds light on what has happened at the end here. Yeah, Chris.
What does this transcendent consciousness have to be the divine? Why can't it be, if you think the state.
What?
A state. I guess the state wouldn't necessarily give consciousness. Is that the problem? Or?
Well, I think it is spoken of in terms that make it separate from all of the content of worldly existence, which to some degree harks back from what happened in the skeptical consciousness. You had this consciousness that wanted to remove all of the determinacies, all the determinacy of the given, because it wasn't something that could be found to be intrinsically in the form of thought. So thought had to take this role of being an active obliterator, but that thinking was a consciousness that was divorced from all of that content. And that becomes this kind of consciousness that transcends everything worldly determinate, as opposed to the consciousness that is aware of all of that, immersed in that, and even has a life that is part of that. So for that reason, I don't think you can speak of it as a worldly entity that could be ascribed to consciousness. Like, if you want to think of the state somehow in those terms, I think it would fit the bill. But, you know, the term of the arguments are ones that don't characterize in any further way than as a consciousness, and one that's transcendent. Now, whether that means that you don't want to say anything about it being divine, you of course have to ask, what are you adding, if anything, if you do say speak it's divine? And clearly, I think from what was suggested earlier, is that the divine need not have this form. Right? One can, and the divine has been construed in forms of religion that Hegel will take up later on. That don't involve thinking of the divine as consciousness, as a consciousness.
Yeah. I don't know if I'm following much here. How can an individual in a central consciousness takes its own self-sacrifice, sacrifices on the part of the central consciousness? How does that...
With the deed of the willing.
How does it sacrifice itself? How is that...
How is that what?
How is it a deed of divine? How do you define sacrifice itself. What is that? What is the sacrifice?
Well, in a way, it's not sacrificing itself. It's more this inessential inessential consciousness, which sees its own truth, lying not in its inessential doings, but in something else. It's sacrificing the unessential, but in other words, its deed, as Hegel's here saying, for consciousness has this negative character. But in itself, it's this positive willing of the divine. If it were not that, I mean, that's how it's taken by consciousness. If it were not that, then it would just be another endeavor of consciousness, where it hasn't. It hasn't effaced its own willing. It's just engaged in another engagement as before. So rather here it regards itself as submitting itself entirely to this external authority, which it holds to be essential, and has acted against all of its inessential strivings. And if it's not going to regard that as an inessential striving, it has to attribute it, right, to the universal that consciousness is trying to unite with. But is that what is going on in truth? Can that be what is going on in truth? Insofar as there still is throughout this, there still is this abiding discrepancy. Because that it is this universal is still not its deed. It hasn't succeeded in uniting itself in a positive way with what is preempting it. But then there's this final move, which we can explore next time to begin with, and maybe see discussed in what follows. It will shed light on this, where in fact, insofar as it has actually been doing all of this itself, the character of what it does do itself now takes on these further features, which allows it to have characterized itself in a way where itself can put itself across as a rational self, whose individual content lays hold of what is essential in objectivity.
Aren't we still being deceived at this point? I mean, before you give us the last
one. You want him to do this last
one. Well, I mean,
because it's or is the deception that what occurred is taking place on the part of this absolute?
Right. That's what I'm asking about, yeah.
Is that the deception?
It seems like that's the deception, that the absolute is sacrificing.
Yeah. Same bad time,
how does Jesus Christ
or is this deception?
Veto, really. Veto.
Or is there something about this whole bifurcation that doesn't allow the transcendent self to actually be what it is taken to be for consciousness?